Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What the fuckadelics? How is it? How is it with you? How is it with you? What is happening? So, look, two guests today. I'm going to talk to first Ed Begley Jr. He's back on the show after 10 years since the first time he's been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, but that didn't keep him from working or from writing his memoir. He had it long before he knew he had it, too. Then we have Jonah Ray Rodriguez. He's back. He used to be Jonah Ray. Now he's the whole name. He was around a lot during the early years of WTF because he was part of that early comedy podcast community. He was one of the side men on the Nerdist. Also, you have time. You still have time to submit a question for our next Ask Mark Anything episode. Go click on the link in the episode description and submit your question on the Google form. I'll give my answers next week on the Full Marin. My 2024 tour kicks off this month in San Diego at the Observatory North Park on Saturday, January 27th, two shows. Then I'm in San Francisco at the Castro Theater on February 3rd, sold out. Portland, Maine, I'm at the State Theater on Thursday, March 7th. If it's functional, I saw pictures of a massive bit of flooding there. Medford, Massachusetts, outside of Boston at the Chevalier Theater on Friday, March 8th. Providence, Rhode Island at the Strand Theater on Saturday, March 9th. Tarrytown, New York at the Tarrytown Music Hall on Sunday, March 10th. Atlanta, Georgia, I'm at the Buckhead Theater again on Friday, March 22nd. Madison, Wisconsin at the Barrymore Theater again on Wednesday, April 3rd. Milwaukee, Wisconsin at the Turner Hall Ballroom again on Thursday, April 4th. Chicago at the Vic Theater on Friday, April 5th. Many times at the Vic. Minneapolis, I'm at the Pantages on Saturday, April 6th. I shot a special there and at the Vic. I'll be in Austin, Texas at the Paramount Theater on Thursday, April 18th as part of the Moon Tower Comedy Festival. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for tickets. Do it. Do it. I don't know if you got this, but they've put out this box set of the Replacements album, Tim, newly mastered. I don't know what the story is on it, but it's the Ed Stasium masters. I guess this is the mastered properly vinyl. I can't stop listening to it. What a great fucking band. What a great fucking record. And what else have I been watching? That's what I'll do right now. I'll tell you what I've been watching. Well, oddly, and I don't know if I owe anybody apologies. I don't know if I need to explain myself too much because James Gray and I, the director, we had a pretty good, pretty great talk. You know, we got to know each other, and he was here for his movie Armageddon Time, which was a good movie. Now, I had seen some of his other movies. I think I watched that. I watched Armageddon Time. I watched Ad Astra. I think I watched The Yards. But the truth of the matter is I've now watched all his movies. I watched The Lost City of Z. That was it. To prep, I think I watched Armageddon Time, Ad Astra, The Lost City of Z, and The Yards. But on the Criterion Channel, they've got all the New York movies. They've got Little Odessa. They've got The Yard. They've got We Own the Night. They've got two lovers, and they've got Immigrant. I've watched all of them. I've watched all of the James Gray movies, and they're fucking amazing. Now, part of me is like, yes, stupid. I mean, you knew he was a great director, but why didn't I watch those movies? All of them, before I talked to him. Because now I probably got to talk to him again. I mean, I can't, you know, he's such a fan of movies, and he's so meticulous about, you know, his eye and what how he wants things to be seen, and his DP must be amazing. But all these movies are like quintessential outer boroughs movies. They all take place in Queens, you know, around there, except for The Immigrant, which is a period piece, takes place right there in the city with a touch of Brooklyn. But Jesus, man, Little Odessa's a gnarly movie. And We Own the Night is fucking spectacular. Two Lovers, which seems like a very personal story, which I'd like to ask him about. I don't know, maybe it's not, but it seems like there's a bit of him in all of these, at least of him watching some shit go down. A lot of Russian immigrants and stuff, and Brighton Beach. But they're all great movies, and you should watch them. Because I don't know, is he an underappreciated director? I would think he thinks so. But I've been enjoying watching all those movies. Yeah. And listening to The Replacements and some jazz and some other stuff. And watching comedy specials like Jacqueline Novak's. I've been engaging in the arts. I just got to go see some paintings and maybe some dance. Maybe I need to see some dance. Maybe I need to dance. I did a little bit of dancing the other day. I put on a Othello record. And I danced a little bit in the way that I dance when I'm by myself. Not, I wouldn't say I was, you know, really expressing myself through dance, but I would say I was sort of like compressing movements. I would say it's more like crumping. Is that what it's called? I wouldn't call it break dancing. I wouldn't call it like freestyle, but I would say maybe crumping. You know, it was kind of. Well, I don't know. I think it's a little more, that seems very expressive to me. I think I was just kind of like kind of old man grooving, sadly. You know where you see, you know, wedding videos and, you know, when, you know, guys my age don't want to look stupid, but they also, you know, don't want to really fucking do what they, you know they can do. So they just kind of groove a little, you know, a little bit of movement. A little bit of the hands with the, you know, the elbows kind of close to the body, move a little bit of the hips and the, you know, and the feet, get a little kind of a circular groove going with both arms. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, you know, a cool daddy dance without going crazy. But I feel like I could cut loose. I feel like I could really jump around. I feel like I could really, you know, kind of get the arms going all over them. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. I'm not going to do it right now, but that's next on the list. Watch movies and do expressive modern dance. Ed Begley Jr. is like a Zelig type of character here in Hollywood in the 70s, all the way through. Knows everybody. In the book, the new book, To the Temple of Tranquility and Step on It, that's the name of the book, pictures of him and everybody for weird reasons. He's just woven into the fabric of Hollywood. It was great to see him. And this is me and Ed Begley catching up. Sometimes I wish I paid more attention in school, or in some cases, any attention at all. There are probably a lot of things I could have gotten more out of, like literature, and now it's probably not in the cards to go back to school and study the classics. But luckily for us, there's a new podcast called The Foxed Page that dives deep into the best books of all time. This is basically like the best possible college English class, but more relaxed and fun. No pressure of grades or needing to prepare something to say in class. It's only the books you want to read and know about, presented by best-selling author Kimberly Ford. Everything from Cormac McCarthy to Madame Bovary, from classics like Frankenstein to modern hits like Lessons in Chemistry. I love Ireland, but I missed the boat on James Joyce. The Foxed Page has a three-part series on Dubliners, and that's a pretty great starting point. Want to get the most out of what you read? The Foxed Page is for you. Get it now wherever you get your podcasts. So we talked a lot about some of the stuff that's all that's in the book, the new book, To the Temple of Tranquility and Step on It. It wasn't that quick a journey, though, was it?
No, it wasn't. I thought I could rush things by finding serenity in a bottle of Stoli and a couple of lines. It doesn't work that way, as it turns out.
Yeah, but like, I mean, but when you really sort of, it seems that through the stories that when you really did get sober, you understood that whatever it was you were looking for was not the thing.
Exactly. I had it all along. All I had to do was just stay sober and enjoy the moments, have some semblance of gratitude, and you'd be just fine.
Yeah, kind of, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But in this book, because, like, look, I don't want you to tell the story so much because you want people to buy the book, but in the book it says you smoked a joint with Charlie Manson?
I did. We smoked a joint with Charlie, and my friend James and I drove up to see his friend David Kurland.
Yeah.
When I did the show the last time, I didn't know, couldn't remember his name, but my friend James reminded me. We went to college together, James Jeremias and I.
Yeah.
And this guy lived in a treehouse next door to a saloon.
Yeah.
And it turned out that saloon was the Spahn Ranch movie set.
Oh, okay. So that was how, that's how you got up there.
Yeah.
Now, did you see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
I did.
How was the depiction of that?
It's, I don't know where they shot it, but it could, they certainly made it look like the Spahn Ranch. It looked like the way I remember it.
It felt like that?
Yeah, it did.
Like just with dirty hippies everywhere?
Yeah, and rundown old movie sets, you know, Western town kind of stuff.
Yeah. How'd that, well, you came up in Hollywood, you grew up here, your dad's obviously was a character actor, but how did that movie feel to you in terms of the way it looked? Did it look like your past?
Very much so, and all the stuff that they did where they put in CGI, you know, all kinds of Sunset Boulevard, Hollywood Boulevard stuff.
Yeah.
Musso and Franks is still the same, they didn't have to do anything to that.
Right, but the vibe was correct?
100% correct.
It was a good time, wasn't it?
It was very much a good time. Alcohol and drugs were a great time until suddenly it wasn't in 76 when I had the DTs for the first time. Before that, it was great.
Oh, that story in here about you driving and getting in that car accident?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Totally crazy.
The sound that you heard in the car after?
Bang, bang, bang. I'm wondering, what the fuck's wrong with my car? Anybody know what that sound is? And the poor guy with the crutches whose car destroyed said, yeah, you're knocking the mirrors off the parked cars. Can you let me out? I said, no, I'm going to take you home. Let me out of the car. No, I'll take you home. He starts hitting me in the head with his crutch saying, let me out of the car, you fucking maniac.
Yeah. That was like, when was that?
That was 75, Christmas 75.
So you were close. You were close to getting sober.
Yeah.
But here it says, like just to read this, because in the sense that, like, the book is constructed of, you know, they're basically memoir essays. They're stories from your life that you've chosen are the ones.
Right.
Were there others?
Oh, yeah, lots of other crazy nights.
That didn't make the book, or is this pretty much a tight, like, did you write a bunch more, and your editor said, we don't need this one?
I didn't write any more than that. It's pretty much the way I wrote it. I was a little short at first, so I added some more that I hadn't thought of.
Yeah.
And, but I think it's all pretty much in there that I can remember now.
Yeah.
It's incredible to me how much I can remember about the distant past like that. And then, you know, walking in the garage this morning, I have no fucking idea what I went in there for. Not a clue.
Today?
Yeah.
But did it come to you?
It came to me. Oh, yeah, Mark Maron, 11.
So it was me. I was the thing that got lost.
No, it was long before 8 a.m. I went in for some tool and I couldn't remember what it was.
Yeah. Have you been in hundreds of movies and TV shows?
I have, hundreds.
It's crazy, right?
Yeah, that's crazy. To still be working after, 57 years?
Yeah.
That's kind of nuts.
Yeah, and you were great in Better Call Saul. Was that the last
thing? Thank you, yeah. And I do Young Sheldon. I did that a little more recently.
Mm-hmm.
But Saul was a great show. Sheldon's a great show. I'm very lucky to still be doing it.
And you go back to, you know, to sort of a bit about your dad, Ed Begley Sr., who I just watched in 12 Angry Men.
God, do I love that movie.
It's some movie, right?
What a cast. What a movie. Sidney Lumet.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Now, did you know any of those other guys?
I met them, you know, one by one over the years. Not all of them. I never met George Voskovic. I never met John Fiedler, I knew. I knew Ed.
Fonda?
I knew Henry Fonda for sure.
Yeah? Why, was he a buddy?
I met him around, and I did a play for a while. I didn't make it to opening night. I was an understudy in Kane Mutiny Court Martial at the Center Theater Group. So he was a star of that. I got to meet him there.
Oh, okay. But was he like friends with your dad?
He very much was friends. I've got a lovely little gift he gave my dad, a little silver, yeah. like ashtray or something,
yeah.
sterling silver, nice thing. I have it on my mantle.
You got a bunch of memorabilia from the old
Yeah, my dad's
days.
Oscar, my dad's Tony Award.
What did he win the Oscar for?
Sweet Bird of Youth, 1962, Paul Newman, Geraldine Page.
Best Supporting?
Best Supporting is right.
Yeah.
Rip Torn's in that. He should have gotten an Oscar, too. He's sure good.
Wow. So it's like, I think this was what was interesting to me, too, about the last time, is that because of your childhood, you sort of span these generations
right.
of actors.
I met one of the Keystone Cops from Silent Films. I literally met the guy. So I have a bridge in my life of experiences from Silent Films to Sean, the guy that made the film on his iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
That incredible filmmaker.
Tangerine?
Yeah, Tangerine.
Sean Baker, yeah,
right?
Sean Baker, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, really good.
He's a good filmmaker.
He sure is. So made it on his iPhone.
Yeah.
The size of a cigarette pack.
Well, the first one, I think he opted for cameras.
I think he might have.
After that. I think he had something to prove, and he proved it, and then someone said, here's a little money, go get a camera.
Yeah, get a camera. Life's going to be a little easier on you.
But I mean, what was the backstory? Was there a strange backstory between you and your mom and your dad and like a mystery?
A big mystery, and that I discovered when I got my driver's license. I went to get my learner's permit, you know, to get my driver's license. And to do that, you have to have your birth certificate to prove, you know, to the DMV you are who you are and you're the age that you say.
Yeah.
So I had never held it before. I'm in the back seat of the car. My dad's driving over Coldwater to get back the valley from his business manager in Bev Hills. And I open the thing and I go, Dad, why is there no mother's name on my birth certificate? Long silence finally goes, because Amanda wasn't your mother. The woman I knew to be my mother died when I was 7.
Yeah.
Suddenly she's not my mother, okay?
Yeah.
Who was my mother?
Yeah.
Sandy's your mother. Double explosion. Because this woman I knew and loved, this woman, Sandy, gave me a gift on my birthday, gave me a Christmas gift. I'd see her at Grand Central Station. You know, something about this woman, I just loved her. It turned out to be Mom.
Yeah? And what did Sandy do?
She was a page at NBC that my father took up with and had 2 children with, though he was quite actively married to another woman, Amanda.
Yeah, and so he has a child with Amanda as well?
He has no children with Amanda. He was purported to have had a child with Amanda. I grew up and knew to be my brother, Tom, but it turned out Amanda was not his mom.
Either?
My father's sister, my Aunt Helene, was the mother of Tom, as it turns out.
Oh.
And we never learned who the father was, but we recently learned from 23andMe that he's an Ashkenazi Jew.
Huh.
We're quite Irish people, and we have a wonderful Ashkenazi Jewish person in our life.
100%? 100% Ashkenaz?
I think so.
Wow. So that's interesting. Well, he would have been half, because your aunt's still Irish, right?
Yeah, she's pretty Irish, yeah.
Yeah. So he's half Ashkenazi, half Irish, whatever that is. That kind of thing always amazes me because of the sort of jarring reconfiguring of your life you have to do in a moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jack Nicholson had it too. The woman that he thought to be his sister was his mother.
Was his mother.
Yeah, he was the woman. He was raised as this woman's brother.
Yeah.
Turned out that was Mom. The sister was his mom.
What was the reason for that?
The scandal, same as it was in my case. You know, trying to keep the scandal in check. The Catholic scandal the sin and the Pope and the bishops and all of that bullshit.
Right, and the community.
Exactly.
The pressure.
Exactly.
Are you still friends with Jack?
Yeah.
Is he all right?
He's great.
Okay, good.
He's in great shape. He's mentally in every way. He's really cool still.
Enjoying his life?
He is.
Yeah.
He's got great kids, great grandkids.
And they're all out there around, hanging out? They're all around, hanging out?
Oh, yeah. They love him.
Oh, that's great. Because there's a whole piece in here about your relationship with Harry Dean, who I had an experience with that wasn't great, because I don't know what I was thinking. You know, I chose to interview him after, that woman, what's her name, Sophie Huber? Is that her name? The one who did the doc?
Yes, Sophie.
But I saw that doc, and I'm like, I'm going to go out there and talk to him. And she couldn't get him to talk in the doc. And I think, I'll get it. And then you go out there, and he's like, eh.
No.
You're not going to. No, not really.
One word answers, yes.
One word answers. And I think I made him angry out of the gate, about.
That doesn't sound like Harry Dean Stanton.
Well, not.
I'm totally kidding. He got pissed out of the gate with a lot of people. That was his goat. That was his default setting.
I mentioned something about smoking at his age, and that was it.
Yeah,
I
was done.
Yeah, I was done. But you knew that guy forever, huh?
I met him in 72. He was the one that introduced me to Alan Watts, whatever measure of serenity I have in my life. I got it through him.
Well, that's the essay you wrote in the book. Yeah, so, but the contradiction is of the life you guys led.
Yeah.
And then still kind of finding this Buddhist thought.
Yeah, but he was one of the most impatient guys in traffic in every way I've ever met. Harry Dean was.
Yeah.
But always was a proponent of serenity and being in the now.
Right.
He achieved it on his couch there up on Mulholland a good deal of the time, but not so much outside of the home.
Yeah, and you guys were regulars at Dantana's forever?
Every night.
Yeah.
When I say every night, I mean every single night. Finally, we were not there for like a week because we had both gotten a job in the same movie, so we were both missing for a full week. So I said, we should call up Guido and tell him we're okay. We'll call up, talk to Guido, the maitre d' at Tana's. Yeah. They had sent somebody by Harry Dean's house to see if we'd fallen asleep with the gas on or something. They thought we'd literally perish.
Yeah.
How could we both not be there for a full week?
We
used to go after Tana to go back to his place and watch the Z Channel or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And so they literally thought we were dead.
But you weren't.
We were alive
cockfight with Warren Oates.
Yep.
What's the director?
Monty Hellman.
Monty Hellman. I remember that movie being a little difficult to understand.
It was for me to understand, and I was in it. Same with Two Lane Blocktop. I'm not sure what that's about.
Yeah, I'm not either. That was Dennis Wilson, right?
It's James Taylor.
Oh, James Taylor.
Maybe Dennis Wilson's in it with him, but James Taylor is the star of it, I think.
Wow.
Laurie Bird is a co-star.
I talked to James Taylor. He's sober, too. Boy, he was out there.
Was he ever?
Oh, yeah.
And he didn't quit after the fourth time with heroin. He stayed a little longer at the party.
Yeah, and his dad had to come get him. And, you know, it was like, I didn't realize that guy was so in the mire of it.
Yeah.
But I guess a lot of people were.
A good many of my friends.
Yeah.
Very few of them are alive.
So the other thing, like, I just want to, like, read this list because in the book, I don't know if people put you into context, but you said there's, like, you would regularly spend time with Groucho Marx in his home and occasionally enjoy a sweepover. You played Trivial Pursuit with the Clintons. You would get to know and work with Kirk Douglas, Meryl Streep, Peter Falk, Alan Arkin, Michael Caine, Billy Wilder, Richard Pryor, David Mamet, who I just saw, Jeff Goldblum, Eric Idle, Denzel Washington, Buck Henry, Don Henley, Jane Fonda, Gina Davis, Dabney Coleman, Lily Tomlin, Leonardo DiCaprio, Vince Gilligan, John Cleese, Danny Glover, Harvey Keitel, William Hurt, Larry Kasdan, Larry David, Angelica Houston, Pam Grier, Penny Marshall, Alfre Woodward, Taylor Swift, Jeff Bridges, Yaphet Kotto. I just watched Midnight Run again. He was so good.
It's one of the best movies ever.
Rob Reiner and Christopher Guest. Now,
partial list.
Huh?
List.
Of course, partial list. But, well, I mean, there's a picture in here that I didn't get to the essay, but I need you to explain to me, where you're just sitting, you're making dinner for the Best Actor Oscar nominees for Hugh Jackman, Robert De Niro, Alan Arkin, Tommy Lee Jones, Joaquin Phoenix, and Daniel Day-Lewis. How does that happen?
I was a governor of the Academy that year, and the president of the Academy was Howard Koch Jr., a junior like me. And he said, here's what I want to do this year. Annette Bening's going to take the ladies. You take the men, Ed. And at your house, just host a little lunch. And we're going to have all the nominees and jeans and cutoffs, whatever they want. No cameras, no nothing.
Yeah.
You know, no photographers.
Right.
We're going to take pictures of each other. That's fine.
Yeah.
But and it'll be just a casual kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And so I cooked. They had a caterer for me. I said, do you mind if I cook? And nobody seemed to mind at all, so I made them a nice vegan meal, and they all liked it.
Yeah? And what was the point of that, just for everyone to hang out?
So they could hang out without any pressure, without any press people coming up and asking questions or eavesdropping on a conversation between the two of them.
And they might not have, like, I imagine that's the first time some of them hang out together.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're kind of in the press line together, say, I loved you and such and such.
Yeah,
I loved you and such and such.
So it was just a kind of casual pre-Oscar thing.
Yeah, for those who wanted to come, they're invited. Those who didn't want to do yet another event that weren't obliged to come.
Right.
And it was a brand new thing, so there's no history. Every actor comes and does this. How could you not do this? Anybody who wants to come. They only did it a few years, as it turns out, but it was great honor.
Must have been a good lunch.
It was a good lunch. People seemed to like it.
Who won that year?
Who won? I think Alan Arkin won for Little Miss Sunshine, didn't he?
Oh, yeah.
And I think,
God damn it, he was so good. I think about that character all the time.
Yeah.
The character he played in Little Miss Sunshine
wonderful.
All the time.
Wonderful.
It's wonderful, but as a drug addict, you're like, that guy had it figured out.
Yep. Totally.
You know, until he didn't, but...
Right.
But just sort of like... And I guess that's not a good indication of where I'm at mentally.
Right.
That, you know, this like, you know, 60, 70-year-old man who's quietly chipping away at heroin on a trip with his family seems completely to understand himself.
Yeah.
Wow,
I would have done that if I could have pulled it off, but it turns out I couldn't.
No, I can't do anything. Like right now, I'm on these nicotine lozenges and it's driving me nuts. I was off all the nicotine for 3 years and then like, you know, but it's anything, dude. You know, you get to a point, you know what the score is. I think you talk a little bit about compulsive sexual behavior in here.
All of it.
Yeah. What's that chapter about you sleeping with your ex?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a payoff to that I won't give away, but I became very close to my ex-wife and my current wife fully approved.
Wow.
Yeah. It's not as salacious as it sounds, but it's pretty funny.
But there's so many great pictures in here. You and Waits as kids.
Oh, me and Tom.
Yeah.
We're still pals. I talked to him just the other day.
Yeah.
What a great guy he is. What an artist. What a career.
Sure, man.
Isn't he amazing?
Yeah. What was the, why did you decide to write this book now? Were you just, was it COVID or what happened?
It started innocently enough. It was really my daughter's idea. My daughter Hayden, 24 now. She was 22 at the time. It was just 2 years ago. She said, I'm going to get my smartphone and just start telling me some of the stories about, you know, you and Marlon Brando and the Electric Eels, and tell me about your father and your grandfather and coming over on the boat from Ireland and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I started just for my family, for my grandkids and my kids.
Yeah.
To, you know, get some of the stories down. And I did. I started to write some of the stories, not write them down, but dictate them to my daughter. But she has a life. She couldn't do that forever. So in her absence, I thought, before I forget some of this shit, I got to type it up and get on my computer and write it up to hand her to, you know, transpose it all.
Yeah.
And then it happened. The computer keyboard became like a Ouija board that actually worked.
Yeah.
And suddenly I'm taken up to the attic of my mind and the basement of my mind to these things I hadn't thought of, you know, like smoking a joint with Charlie Manson or, you know, charging my car at O.J. Simpson's house. And
yeah.
All that stuff, just like things I haven't thought of in many years, that kind of brought it all together. Just the practice of typing one thing would lead you to another and another.
That's the best part of writing. Outside of that, it's a miserable undertaking.
Yeah.
I have found.
Exactly. But I literally couldn't wait to get back to the computer every day. I'd had some TV show or movie to work on. I go, come on, what time do I get released? I just wanted to get back to the dressing room with the home and start writing more.
Because it's like an excavation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The best kind.
Yeah. And were you able to experience the emotions?
Very much so. I'm even feeling some of it right now.
Yeah? Like what about in particular?
Just about my daughter wanting to do that and, you know, how much my kids mean to me and how much my grandkids mean to me.
Yeah.
The fact that they all really love the book. I did it for them and they love it, which was that was the stated goal.
Well, that's an amazing thing to, because so many times, you know, no matter who your kids are, who you are, your kids have, they're their own people. So they don't really know the depth of you.
Right.
So, you know, and you had a fairly colorful life.
I did. So, and I'm not going to remember it forever. So get it down now and hand it to them in printed form so they can remember.
And what were their reactions to it, the ones that could grasp it?
They flipped out. They thought it was really good. But they made me believe they think it's good.
Well, I mean, did they know most of the stories or some they didn't know?
They knew most of them. My grandkids didn't know maybe a quarter of them. But
how old are your grandkids?
I've got a 20-year-old grandson, a 15-year-old granddaughter, and a 2-year-old grandson.
Wow.
I'm blessed. I could have great grandkids. This is possible.
Yeah, it might happen.
It might happen.
Good talking to you, Ed.
Always great talking to you, Mark. Thank you.
And the book is great. It's good stories, and they, you know, they're all separate. So it's not like one. It's one narrative, but each one is really is sort of a raconteur's book.
Bless you, pal.
All right, buddy. There you go. To the Temple of Tranquility and Step On It is available now wherever you get your books. Now, okay, so Jonah Ray Rodriguez. Like, I would have pronounced it Rodriguez, but, you know, he can do what he wants. You know what I mean? It's his fucking name, right? It's spelled kind of like Rodriguez, but it's Rodriguez. It's okay. It's all right. I knew him as Jonah Ray back in the day. But he's in this new movie. It's a kind of a horror movie, a horror comedy, a satire of a horror movie, but kind of a horror movie because many horror movies are kind of satires. It's called Destroy All Neighbors, and it's now playing in theaters and streaming on Shudder. He did it with Alex Winter. It's a lot of that over-the-top gory stuff, a lot of blood and guts and funny, you know, that great mixture of funny and blood and guts. Got some funny people in it. Alex is in it. He's got Tom Lennon's in there. But it was good to see Jonah. It was funny because sometimes I get overwhelmed and I forget to check my schedule. And I was doing a Zoom notes meeting with my good friend Sam Lipsight about the script we're working on. And the doorbell rings. I wasn't expecting anybody. And it's Jonah. I'm like, what's up? And I'm like, oh, fuck, is that today? He goes, isn't it? And I'm like, yeah, I guess. I don't know. Yeah, I believe you. He's like, you want me to come back? I'm like, no, dude, let's do it. I know you. I don't know. I don't need to go crazy with the prep. I watched a movie and we're friends. So this is me talking to Jonah Ray Rodriguez, you know, on just like, boom, just happened. I guess I can leave that heater on for a minute.
I don't mind it.
Maybe if I turn the turbo off. That made a difference.
Yeah, maybe this conversation will get so heated that we won't need
the heat.
Yeah.
I just need a little bit. I just need a taste. Yeah. I just need a taste of heat. It's a little chilly in here.
It's so cold.
I don't understand what's happening. I don't mind it. It's not too cold.
It's too cold for me. I'm going to keep the jacket on.
Well, you're a Hawaii guy.
Yeah. I've never acclimated to the cold weather.
It's been never went anywhere where you could. Did you?
No, I just from Hawaii to straight to here.
Yeah.
So what am I? I hate it. The coldest I ever felt was I was leaving a show at the end of a Mystery Science Theater tour in Minneapolis November, and like they're like, oh, just to let you know, the walkways, you know, those little habit trails they have, they're like, oh, those are closing. I'm like, that's fine. The hotel is only like two blocks away.
Yeah.
One block in, I literally said out loud to my friends, I was like, go on without me. I'm not going to make it. Like my body just starts seizing up.
With the windshield, but that's real cold in
that's real
Minnesota,
cold.
Yeah.
Yeah. I shot a movie last January in Iowa,
yeah.
Like outside of Des Moines in
yeah.
January, nighttime, sub-zero temperatures. It was gnarly. It was me and Kirk Fox, and we were really, really upset the whole time.
And when they were giving you those dumb hand warmer packets?
Yeah, I was like loading up with those. I
had thermals. You got the thermal
underwear. And I had like
on.
Electric jacket on underneath
yeah.
my wardrobe. And then
oh my God.
Run into like the RV.
Was that worth it? How'd that film come out?
I haven't seen it yet. I also got shingles during it. So.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I was like the first day we were shooting, I was like, I do not feel good. I feel like my brain was feeling like it was cramping. And so I looked up what an aneurysm feels like, and it turns out it just happens all of a sudden. But and then I went to a doctor. And
no time
like,
to think.
No time to think. Yeah. It's just you're gone. And what a great way to go.
Yeah. Quick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just sort of like, ouch.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's like, hot. Hopefully mid word or mid joke or like after a setup.
I don't think I feel.
Yeah. You know, it'd be funny.
Hey, wait.
One more thing. Am I blowing out, or is that just my cans, or is that just my ears?
No, you're not blowing out.
All right, just checking.
I mean, I can. I don't know which cans are. Hold on, let me see.
I sound messed up. You sound fine.
How do you? Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't know what.
It doesn't matter.
Well, I mean,
no one's going to listen to this.
I've been doing this a long time, and I should have the equipment that works right. I don't think it's an issue with blowing out on the levels. It's something to do with the cans.
Yeah, but did you notice how quickly I put it on myself as it being something wrong with me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought you were over that. What's the matter with you?
Yeah.
I thought you're all better. I thought skinny Jonah had his shit together.
I remember we were on the phone and you're like, I was saying, yeah, I'm feeling pretty good. You're like, we were all waiting for it.
Yeah.
We were all hoping you would come around. I don't know. It's peaks and valleys, waves. I feel generally better, I guess, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you look well. I think the big weight loss over the years was good.
Yeah. And I've gained some back, you know, because, you know, during the strikes.
I didn't want to say anything,
but. Yeah. You noticed it? Yeah, don't worry.
No, I didn't.
So, like, you know, the strikes really, like, that's, during the strikes, I picked up a bartending gig.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, it was.
Where at?
I was working at Block Party on New York Boulevard.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, between 15 and 51.
Is that where your girlfriend work or your wife?
No. She works at another place now. Yeah. She doesn't bartend anymore. But, like, yeah, I started, like, I ran into, like, one of the owners, and, like, they're like, how are the strikes going?
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm fucking scared and broke.
Yeah.
And they're like, do you want to bartend on the weekends? And I was like, sure. And I thought it was just like a beer place. So yeah. I'd just be, you know, slamming beers.
So you had to really learn the cocktail business?
There's all kinds. I was like, which one's shaken and which one's stirred?
Oh, no.
And this one comes with the big ice cube.
The sort of like baptism and fire of mixology.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, I'm super, you know, very fortunate that like I was able to get any kind of job. You know, I don't
Did
have
you
any-
pull it off?
Yeah, I'm still there, man. Like,
you're still bartending on weekends?
Yeah. And also, like, you know, like the Vidiot's, the theater, they've asked me to do a couple nights. I don't know what's happening. I might be becoming more bartender than
They got a bar at Vidiot's?
Yeah, in the lobby.
A full bar?
No, just beer and wine.
How's that place? I haven't been over there.
The screen and the sound are great.
Really?
The programming is really excellent.
Big screen.
It's a whole huge, nice theater.
No shit.
Yeah, you should present something there. It's a lot of fun.
You got me hooked up with American Cinematheque, and now I had to join.
Yeah.
I had to join. I couldn't pull the, like, hey, I'm a friend of the, you know, friend and family kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I wanted to get it. Yeah, it's a good organization, so I joined so I could go, so I could get hip to the tickets.
Yeah, well,
I'm
then
go
also.
See Paris, Texas tomorrow.
At the Egyptian?
Yeah.
Man, I haven't been there since they renovated.
Me neither.
I heard it's amazing.
What a great movie to see.
Yes, I love that movie.
I watched it recently. I love it.
You know, you ever try to explain that movie to somebody and it's a little difficult?
Well, it was difficult for me because I didn't know what it was about. I saw it when I was in my 20s and I don't think I ever knew what it was about. Because the entire movie, it's all explained in the Peep Show.
Yeah. That's, you don't find out what's going on until then, pretty much.
Right, and it's pretty heavy.
It's super heavy. And
but that's the movie. It's like, you know, guy was wandering around for years. You don't really know why. It's because, you know, he was a monster and his wife set him on fire.
Yes. Yes. It's, you know, it's like, I think about so many movies I want to revisit that I watched when I was a kid.
I've been doing that.
You know, because like when you're younger, it's like, and like you want to, you know, you put on the personality of like, I'm a movie guy or I like this stuff. And then you watch it and then, but you have no, you know, you're watching like some kind of like drama and you're like, I don't get it. Why don't they just stay together? Like, well, what's so hard about that?
Or even if you study film, when you're in your 20s, you're in your 20s.
You have no idea.
Even if you're trying to backload stuff into, well, not backload it, but like load it up with like things you read and think you, there's a depth you're not going to have. And you see all the movies then, but you're in your 20s.
I was thinking about this the other day about, you know, it's not this like, this is not like this is cinema, but like, High Fidelity, where when I was younger, I was like, I was thinking John Cusack was such like so cool.
Right.
Then you watch him as an adult, you're like, what an asshole the whole time.
Yeah.
And he doesn't ever really learn his lesson. It's just that his ex-girlfriend comes back.
Well, yeah. Well, we all aspire to be assholes of one kind or another.
I try my best not to be, but then like that also entails like becoming a monster, you know?
But I mean, like when you're younger, you know, the bad guys kind of like, you have different relationships with people in movies.
Sure, yeah.
And you may not see their faults in the same way because you're not a complete person.
Yeah.
You know, and so then you have to, but like watching grown-up movies again when you're a real grown-up, I've been doing it a lot.
Yeah.
I did it with Dog Day Afternoon too, and that's why I
just rewatched that. Because when I was a kid, I think I was like, this seems a little sillier than it's supposed to be. Maybe they didn't, you know, like I thought it was, you know, they were missing the mark.
Yeah.
And then you watch it and it's just such a great movie, overall movie.
Yeah.
And it's one of those old movies too, where it's like, it is intense and it is dramatic and it is funny.
Yeah.
It just has all the stuff.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be one thing.
It's amazing. And I'm not even sure I ever saw it. That's because if I saw it when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Like my parents brought me.
And when you know things culturally, you just think, like, I'm pretty sure I saw Casablanca.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have to do it on purpose.
Yeah.
I remember you having, there's movies I have to do on purpose still that I haven't done yet.
Oh, well, it's because sometimes you're looking at a movie, you're like, I know I should watch it, but it's probably going to bum me out.
Or just sort of like, I don't know, man. I don't even understand why I don't watch some movies.
Yeah.
Like, there's some amazing foreign movies from back in the day that I don't watch because I'm just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
But then I watch this Anatomy of a Fall, and I'm like, I like French movies.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, I always think it's like, I should probably eventually see Seven Samurai because I've seen all the other versions of
the movie. Well, that's good. That's a good movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, Seven Samurai's great. Rashomon's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The High and Low, it's great. Yeah,
but I don't know, you know, I don't think I've seen those since I was in college, and it's been a long time. And those, theoretically, if a movie's like a masterpiece, why not check in with it every year or two?
Yeah, well, I think that because we have so much, so many options to watch so many things, that we rarely rewatch things as much as we used to.
I've been doing it more.
I've been trying to do it more. Like, you know, rewatching stuff. I think it's such a a nice thing to do because when you pick up on stuff, you
I think I rewatched Midnight Run 3 times in the last 6 months.
Really? Like, as like, is it because it's comforting or because you're just finding more and more stuff about it?
It's just funny.
Yeah. I mean, it is such a great movie.
It's very funny.
I like it. It's like there's, you know, when they do buddy movies like that or stuff, it's like everything's a little too silly, you know, these days when they make that kind of movie. I'd rather they make like a movie like that where it's just like, you know, Charles Grodin is just like maybe one of the best.
Totally. And De Niro was pretty available too. Like the moment where De Niro finally gives in, it's kind of great. I mean, it's touching.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know why I like, there was another movie I just did that to where I'm just going to watch the beginning of this.
Yeah.
Just get a little, and I just watch the whole fucking thing.
That's why I've been loving Pluto, you know, that streaming service. Because it's like, I'm so tired of looking for something and feeling I should, you know, I have my list of all these important movies. The Red Shoes, you know, they say The Red Shoes is one of the best movies ever made, you know, like, and then I pull up Pluto, and there's some movie that like I've been meaning to watch or that I haven't seen in a long time. Right. And it's like 5 minutes in.
Yeah.
And like old TV. And I go, oh, and then I watch the whole thing.
It's great.
I miss that.
Yeah, I miss coming in the middle.
Yeah,
where you just finish things, you don't feel pressure. You don't feel pressure.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Oh, good. This is a good part. What did I just watch? I've been watching some old ones too. I watched They Live by Night.
Okay,
Nick Ray movie.
Oh
with
yeah,
Farley
yeah.
Granger.
That's right. Yeah,
it's pretty good.
Yeah, another one that like I'm like, you know, you see.
Well, there's a million of those noir things that like, how are you ever going to catch up with that shit?
Yeah, exactly.
But they're all, and sometimes you think like it's old, but like they're pretty compelling.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, I was, you know, only a few years ago that I finally watched Night of the Hunter.
With Charles Laughton?
Yeah.
And Bob Mitchum?
Yeah, it's so, so great. And, like, you know, it's we even threw a reference of it into that new movie I did. It's like, it was just, you know, it's such a fun, weirdly stylized movie, you know?
What's going on with the Mystery Science Theater?
Oh, you know, like, we did after it left Netflix, want anymore, you know, Joel ended up doing another Kickstarter, which I ended up making more money than the first Kickstarter we did.
Yeah.
And then we used that to fund a 13th season of about 12 episodes, I think. And then also, like, created a platform to premiere them on, a proprietary platform. And, you know, it was good. And we had some of the new cast on there. And, you know, I directed a few of the episodes. And, you know, they were fun. We did a
union gig.
Union gig, yeah. And, you know, and then that went, and, you know, then they tried to do, you know, crowd fundraise another season of it,
yeah.
Which I was, you know, not too, I was like, you know, feels like going to the well of the fans a third time,
yeah.
Felt a little, you know, and especially after the year of like, you know, after COVID and after the strikes, it's like everyone was kind of,
right.
You know, so they didn't make their mark on that. Fundraiser, and you know, I feel like I put in a good amount of time on that show. I mean, if they have me back, I'll go back. But like, I feel 3 seasons is pretty good.
Yeah,
it was like my dream. It was a dream come true to do it at all. You know,
it was a nerd dream come true.
Yeah, I mean, just comedy because like you
nerd
know,
nerd punk comedy dream come true.
It's like, you know, the things I was watching on Comedy Central when I was growing up was sure. Like, you know, like you on Short Attention Span Theater,
the worst.
But like, you know, like
I was such a square.
Yes, was. but like the, you know, like watching Kids in the Hall, that was the thing I was thinking about recently about like the things you, you know, do in a career. Like
yeah.
You kind of, you know, scratch off these little things that like, yeah. You know, maybe everything I do for the most part has been stuff that would make me feel a little less lonely if I was like a 12-year-old kid.
Yeah.
And I take this like metaphysical ball of inspiration that of stuff I'm doing and throw it back.
Sure.
To the past and hopefully I catch it and continue to do it. But also I realize that's just me trying to impress my inner child, but not actually hang out with them.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, you got to get them up to speed, and sometimes, like you know, you lose touch with them, and then when you actually manifest things that he once liked, perhaps there's closure there.
But I don't know if it is that. It's like you know, I'll be go back to my inner child and be like, "Hey, you liked Mystery Science Theater? Look, I'm on that now." And they're like,
yeah.
"Oh, that's really cool, but you should just probably talk to me and hang out with me." No. Hold on. You liked stand up, right? You did a Comedy Central stand up show.
Yeah,
like,
I just really need to grow up.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of like that's why I stopped doing stand up.
Really?
So, yeah. I don't know if we ever talked about that. Where early 2020, I
don't know. Was there stand up to stop?
I was.
The last time I saw you do stand up was at the Masonic Hall in Detroit.
Yes, that's right.
You opened for me.
Yeah, I did 3 shows with you. And
yeah.
I had to like bail in the middle of like our.
Yeah, what happened?
Because I had to go. Well, I did all the shows, but I had to fly to Cleveland to go to my like friend's, my childhood friend's dad's funeral. And then like,
that's right. Yeah, yeah, right. I remember. Yeah. That was sad.
Yeah, super sad. And it was like, you know, it was a little, because like, you know, my dad had just died a few years before that.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was, you know, it was early 2020. I booked a bunch of my own shows.
Yeah.
You know, one-nighters in the Pacific Northwest. So I did like, you know, Seattle, Portland.
Right before COVID?
And, yeah, like in January, February. And I filled up the shows and the shows went great.
Yeah.
But I just didn't, wasn't feeling it. Like, I just didn't feel it. And I started to kind of go like, you know, there was this feeling I had after my dad died where I wasn't sure if I wanted to do stand-up anymore. And the joke I had about it was like, I think it's because I don't know who to try and prove wrong anymore.
Yeah, I get that.
And then I kind of started to...
Who am I yelling at?
Yeah, yeah. What am I, like, what am I doing? This thing that kind of...
Why am I still mad?
It brings me a bunch of anxiety every single time. And it's, you know, worked out really well. Uh-huh. But it was, you know, I started to kind of feel, you know... 2020, I was, you know, almost towards 40, and I realized I started to feel like an incomplete person. You know, I feel like I, it's like, you know, I started at 20 years old and like, I got attention kind of early on.
Yeah.
Like I met all of you guys and started like being on the M-Bar shows, the Comedy Death Ray, and I got on TV kind of fast. And, you know, it's not like I was like, I like blew up, but like I got attention, but I was like 21, you know, 20 years old, 21 years old. And I kind of like was this like, you know, floppy hipster kid. And I was like, well, this is what my material is about. This is what's getting me attention and jobs and money. And I was like, I better stay like this, like mentally and emotionally.
Oh, yeah.
So I can continue to have this output that people are coming to me for. And
it started to go away on you.
Yeah, I just kind of encased my, you know, and then I started like getting towards 40 and go, why do I feel like an incomplete adult? Why do I feel like
Can't feed it either, because like all your peers are growing up and you're like, you're all, your generation is all growing up and whatever was going on when, you know, 20 years ago. And 10 years after that, I came to that late, but there is a generation of that, that kind of comedy ultimately just faded away.
Yeah. Yeah, it really
and,
did.
And so, you know, it seems like a natural course of things.
Yeah.
That as your generation got older, you were like, I don't think this is what we talk about anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it's like, you know, not getting girls or, you know, jerk it off or, you know, nerdy stuff. Like, it's like, I kind of was just like, I was like, what am I doing?
Right.
I don't feel like an adult. And I'm like, you know, like I'm in my late 30s. I'm like almost 40. Like I should not be like, you know, I started having an opinion on things like, or a take on things.
Sure.
You know, I started like really resenting everything. And, you know, like going into comedy, like I started doing stand-up because I didn't know how else to get into show business.
Right.
Like, I always loved it, but like, you know, you come to LA and, you know, like, it always felt like doing comedy was like almost like this unattended back door into show business and entertainment.
It wasn't so much a back door. It was kind of a front door.
It was just left open.
Yeah, yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
Because you had the wherewithal.
You put your name on a list at an open mic and you get on stage and you're in like LA or New York. It's like, you're in show business, baby.
And it's interesting though, the whole idea of that, your generation of alt comedy. Everyone kind of grew up, and that whole world is kind of gone.
Yeah.
And a few people surfaced out of that, but not many. Most of the comics that really made good on it were kind of club comics a bit before.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You know, it's...
And then the whole Nerdising. You were there in Chris's...
And that was the other part of that whole thing of, like, you know, being a part of that scene and then the whole nerd, you know, takeover of culture.
Yeah.
And I, you know, really benefited from that and always felt a little out of place with it, you know, because it's like I wasn't necessarily, you know, I like the things I like, but some of them were nerdy, some of them were not.
Right.
So, like, the nerds didn't really, you know, think I was nerdy enough. And then, like, you know...
Is that true or is that your inner nerd saying that you're... Like, did you actually have confrontations with nerds who were like, we don't think you have the credentials?
Yeah, sometimes that would happen at live shows. You know, they would just be like, it's like, you don't even like Star Trek. I go, it just is a little boring for me. I get it now as an adult a little more, sure. But it's like, I don't like, you know. And then so, like, you know, everyone's, you know, little tiny little gatekeepers. And so, you know.
I didn't like any of it. I just needed a place to work.
Yeah.
I hated
but, like,
all
also at the same time, you know, it's like that was the thing when me and Kumail were doing the Meltdown show. Sure, it was in the back of a comic book store.
No,
but, like, it was just a good comedy show.
Yeah.
You know, no one, and, you know, the comics that tried to come and, like, you know, I remember, so Dave Attell's, like, always been one of my favorites.
Yeah.
He came and he started kind of be like, what I got to make? make, you know, jokes about comic, like, yeah. And everyone, the audience there was just like, no, just do jokes.
Just do jokes.
And anyone who came would always be funny.
Well, the age of my generation, we're just sort of like, what's the context? You know, you've made me come to this place, you know what I mean? Like, he's just.
Yeah, I've been told I got to do this show.
Yeah.
This hip show.
What is the angle here?
Yeah.
Well, that was always the thing about those nerder audiences is that sometimes the biggest hacks got the biggest laughs because they didn't know the difference. There was no big judgment based on the integrity of comedy.
Yeah.
It was just a bunch of fucking kids.
Exactly. And it's like a lot of people there, it's like, you know, they didn't, you know, like if someone was saying something they like knew about, fine.
Yeah.
But that's not what they were there for. In fact, they probably judged those comics more harshly.
I resented every minute of it.
Sure. But any type, you know, any kind.
No. I mean, I resented that. Like, I just resented that there was a sort of, they were aware that they were taking over culture and it bothered me.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I it's hard for me to like defend or anything like that just because I benefited from it. You know, I benefited from.
No, but everybody was good. It all worked out. There were some funny people and there were still, you know, some funny people came out of that and they're still plugging along. There's a lot of people, I don't know where they are. But you drew a line though. You said no more stand up.
Yeah. I just did. I burnt out. I really, really burnt out. I didn't feel good about it.
But also that wasn't the thing that was carrying you. You know, you want
it was all the other jobs I got from it. Like, you know, but, you know, I had we had the show on Comedy Central and I got, you know, the Comedy Central special, put out records. Like,
oh, that's
you know,
right. Yeah,
I did all the stuff, you know, like,
but you really did it.
And I just didn't, but it didn't, you know, feel like it, but every time I got to do something else, like when I did that, there was that CISA show I did, like Hidden America, that Bourdain parody show.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like when I did that, it was like, it was just another reminder. Like every time I did like film sketches or like music videos or some of that, where it's like a collaborative effort of people making something.
Right.
And it's like that I realized that was such a better way for me to convey my comedic ideas.
Yeah. But you also had chops and confidence from doing stand up for all those years.
Yeah. I mean, even now, like it's like, you know, even though I don't do stand up, like I've been directing specials for other people. Like I directed Kyle Kinane's special. Shocks and Struts, and I did Kirk Bronner's special, Perfectly Stupid, before that. And, you know, that's like with Kurt's special, like I worked on the set with him, and I said, you know, like it's stuff I could never tell myself really with my own material, but I was able to go, like, I was like, hey, you don't need this, you know, you don't need this preamble, like just get to it.
Right.
Or, you know, like this should be over here. You don't realize, you know, like I had the bird's eye view and all the skills and knowledge of how stand up worked.
Yeah, I saw the Kyle one. That was good.
And the Kyle one was great because it's like, you know, he wanted to do it specifically at there. And like I mainly worked on, like, you know, I was like, hey, you should kind of move these things around because you double back. But like, it's like at the same time, he's like, hey, just don't, like, I'll handle the material. You don't have to do kind of what you did with Kurt. With Kurt, like, I tagged stuff and like added, you know, and had fun with it. It's collaborative. But with Kyle, I was like, I'm just going to, like, capture your show, and I want it to be energetic. And
where was that shot? I can't remember.
At Wise Guys in
Salt Lake.
Yeah, Salt Lake.
Yeah, that's all right.
And it's and so, like, you know, going in there with
giving you enough space to shoot that place.
But that's what I liked about, because I was used to that with the way Lance shot the Meltdown show. So I was like, you know, I was like, let's not.
He had less space.
We had even less space there. Wise Guys is bigger. And I was just like, well, let's not make it look like we're just doing a special at some theater. Let's not try to make it look like anything it's not. Yeah. Let's just utilize the space. And so let's, like, you know, bring a TV taping to the club.
Right.
And so shove cameras in there and have them all handheld and have it, like, you know. And also,
you don't,
like,
have any boom? You had room for a boom.
I didn't want one.
Yeah.
I didn't want to have that shot.
Yeah.
I wanted it to feel like a little docu-style, almost kind of like the shots of stand-up in Lenny.
Yeah.
No,
I remember. Yeah. It didn't look like Wise Guys.
Yeah. And like, you know, lighting it a specific way, but then also, like, you know, wanting to, because Kyle can be so animated. So, like, you want to, like, he does a lot of good stuff with his face, but then also he does a lot of turning around kind of bits.
Yeah.
And so, you know, between the two shows, moving cameras around to be able to capture that stuff and work between the two sets and cut back and forth.
That's what you got to do. Yeah.
You know, make it seem like you have, like, you know, 20 cameras in that place.
Well, yeah, you just need to be able to pick up, you know, what you need.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like,
I don't know. It's, no one's going to reinvent the fucking comedy special. And I've seen every goddamn attempt to do that.
Sure. Because it's never going to be as exciting as being there. So you can't, like, you know, you can't just let
it play. Yeah, I don't think anyone expects that.
No,
I mean,
but you
I
have
think
to
everyone
kind of
knows how to watch a comedy special now.
But you also, like, you know, you need to re-engage the way people's perception of time and, like, you know, brain stimulation happens now. You need to have, like in my opinion, you need to have, like, a roaming camera to get, like, little weird shots of the show throughout, because, like, you need to re-engage the person's eyes. And so they'll see something new that they hadn't seen before, and they will re-engage.
I wonder.
Like, it's kind of how, like, you know, their prefrontal cortex goes, bing. Oh, that's new. You have to give them a little something new.
I guess. I don't know. I don't know. I have to pay attention to how I watch things because I can really kind of watch things.
Yeah.
I don't find like if something's not moving in 30 seconds, I'm like, what's happening?
Yeah. But you're, you know, like it's like, but
I'm old.
You're old. Yeah. Like it's like, you know, there's little tricks and it's not like, you know, like that old MTV 90s thing where it's like every 3 seconds, I think was their rule, you know, and there was always that like a side low angle camera that was in black and white that they would go to and go back. But there's like little tricks you can do to make it a little extra special.
So you're doing
special.
A lot of the directing, a lot of the acting. So you just like, you know, so you accomplished exactly what you wanted to out of stand-up. You were never real.
See, that's why I never wanted to bring it up. When I started doing stand-up, there was like guys like David Taylor and Ari Shaffir. They're like, I was like, oh, I just really want to like act and make movies. And they're like, don't tell anybody that. You should only be doing stand-up for the pure art of it. And I was like, but I still like it, you know? It's like, I like playing music, but I'm not like, it's like, I just do it as a hobby, you know?
We all wanted to do those things. And and maybe you get the opportunity to do them, maybe you don't.
But you got to. There's a lot of people we know that didn't get to.
Yeah, and I don't know if you tried or who the fuck knows. I can't, you know, show business is
random.
That's a nice word for something.
Yeah, I mean, it's like.
It's horrendous.
It is. It's, but I don't know what else I'd want to do. It's, you know, like,
no, but I mean, if you're doing things that you want to do and you can do what you want to do, then that's good.
Sure.
But if you're doing things because you have to do them or you're desperate.
Oh, yeah.
It's not about doing other things. I mean, you get to a certain point in your career where you're like, you want to do things, but it's not, you can't do what you want to do, but you want to do anything.
Yeah.
And that's a bad place to be.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I worked as a producer and writer, like, you know, a lot of like E shows and magazine TV and like countdown shows.
Yeah.
And like, I would always tell myself like, oh, there's a little bit of it's close to what I wanted to do. So
you're learning. You can do that.
But
sure.
I'm also like, who am I to ask for more than this?
No, but I mean, it's just a matter of, you know, you're kind of getting the hours in and then you can do, you know, you're directing comedy specials.
Yeah. Some.
And you know, acting.
Yeah, I am.
Well, what is it? Okay,
but so I'm also bartending, you know, it's like,
yeah,
I also
that's
like,
your choice.
It wasn't really a choice, you know? It's like, I took out, by not, like, doing podcasts anymore, like, you know, my own podcast, by not doing stand-up anymore, I took out a bunch of revenue and kind of, you know, placed bets. I mean, and, like, what I wasn't really expecting was a pandemic and a strike.
Sure.
To kind of, I mean, I've gotten to be in a lot of movies that I think are a lot of fun lately. And, like, I, you know, got to, you know, be a producer. I want to get, like, directed some stuff. But, like, it's like, at the same time, it's, I'm, you know.
Not enough money.
It's not enough money, and that's okay. You know, it's like whatever it takes to kind of keep on making the things I want to make. That's all that really matters to me. You know,
yeah.
You got to set aside ego, and also this idea that we should be acting like we're successful is, I think, another problem that's very pervasive, especially
with
social media. It's like, you know. Yeah. You just kind of go like, it's like, hey, doing this thing. Hey, I'm on this thing. And people just think that's like, you know, you must be making money. But there's a lot of people that are just struggling to get by because there's not a lot of money in showbiz anymore.
That's true. That's a good point, and it's something people need to hear. The thing about acting successful, I don't know if everybody does it, but, you know, even if you just say you're doing things, people assume you're doing okay. I always ask myself, like, how the fuck is that guy making money?
I you know, if I were to, like, take a step back and look at my career, I'd be like, here's a good example.
Yeah.
When I you know, I posted a thing on Instagram about the strikes and, you know, like the discrepancy in money and pay and stuff like that. And like, you know, this is what the strikes are for. I said, like, you know, and also people just assume, like, it's like if you look up my net worth on, you know, the internet says I'm like a, you know, millionaire. And, you know, I say anyway, so
does
I'm
it?
Bartending. Yeah. It says I have like, you know, over $1 million. And so I... Like, you know,
you do. Come on.
I don't. Yeah, and that's the thing. I don't know if just because I'm like not that good or I'm bad with money or, you know, whatever.
Those
things, or
they don't mean
it's a combination of all the things.
I never look at any of that shit.
But like, you know, like, so I posted that I was like a bartender. Judd Apatow, he like messaged me and was like, he's like, is this like an Andy Kaufman bit? And I wasn't sure if he was joking or not. And like, I was like, oh, yeah, man. Yeah, it's like every time someone says, are you Jonah Ray? I go, how dare you insult me?
Yeah.
I'm nothing like that guy. But then I wasn't sure if he was joking. Then like he mentions it to Kumail and he's like, oh, is Jonah really bartending? And Kumail's like, yeah, there's a strike going on. Like, it's like, you know, there's no work for anybody. And Judd's like perception was like, he's like, but he's so funny. I just figured he was a millionaire. And then like my reaction to that is like, Judd, I'm like a straight, white, tall dude. If you didn't make me a millionaire, then no one would have.
What did he say to that?
He was just like, he just laughed, you know.
Yeah.
I was supposed to meet with him next week. I don't know.
It worked. Your whole ploy worked.
Yes. You get into parts of my little violin, folks.
You've got your meeting with Judd. You pulled it off.
It's at the same time. It's like I'm done assuming one thing is going to lead to another thing, because it's like, you know, it rarely ever does.
I don't know. I just know that I do the stand up.
Yeah.
I go do the stand up.
Yeah.
And I come in here and I do this.
Yeah.
And
you're tired.
The other stuff. Well, I'm just tired because like my brain's on fire all the time for one reason or another.
Yeah.
I do a lot of, you know, I enjoy doing this still, and I enjoy doing stand-up as well, but there comes to a point where it's sort of like, do I know how to stop? Am I doing it because I like it? Am I doing it because I'm still excited about what I'm doing, or am I just doing it because I've always just done it?
Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, I started when I was 20, you were, I think, were you 19, 20, 21,
something
like that?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, that's our entire adult lives. It's like, you know, like, yours, you know, three or four more decades than me, but like...
When did I officially start? I think I did my first stand-up when I was like 21 or 22. And then I started, and then like a couple of years, 88, I started working. So I was 25.
Yeah. And then you just kind of, that's the thing. I felt like, you know, that burnout I had when I stopped, it was like, I felt like I'd, since I was 20, sprinting.
Yeah.
And like just running to try and just like get to the next thing.
Oh,
and
yeah, I was just a desperate, spiteful, angry for me.
Yeah.
And
I don't think I never like wanted to admit it. Like it's like, you know, how like jealous, I never wanted to admit how jealous I was of like Harris Whittles. And so that was such a wild thing when he died. Like when he died, like I was.
You won
like,
that one.
I mean, like when he died, like it's like people, like it's like people who knew me, like were like, it was like, how does that make you feel? I said, I don't know. How did fucking Salieri feel when Mozart died?
Wow.
Because he was a brilliant, brilliant guy. And, you know, it's like there's nothing, you know, like a little death that can kind of throw a wrench in things. That's the thing. Like with my dad, like when I was just like, I was like, I don't fucking, why my motivation was just gone to do any of the stuff. Cause it's like, you know, I wasn't there to try and be like, it's like, see, it works, dad, you know?
Yeah. Well, I find that with me, it's not quite the same. It's just a matter of me coming, you know, circling the same topic, same conversations, just different ways.
Yeah.
You know, the same sort of whatever my existential struggles are, whatever my observations are, they seem to be me rephrasing themes that I've done over and over again, which
that's you just trying to figure it out, though.
Yeah, I know, but like it also implies that I'm kind of on a slow circling back.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Well, because you've been doing nothing. It's like that's another thing. I was like, I feel like I exploited every aspect of my life,
right,
like over the years, and I was like, did I even experience anything in an honest way?
Yeah.
Or was I just like experiencing things and going, you know, that'd be funny?
Well,
or did I really recover from any kind of traumatic moment in my childhood or in my early, you know, life?
Right.
It's like, or did I just like joke around about it so much that I felt okay about it?
How do you answer those questions now?
I don't know. It's like, I guess like through art we process.
I mean, like now that you've stopped though, are you processing?
Yeah, now it's kind of starting to come to a head. I'm like, you know, like through like therapy, I'm going to like,
I'm going
to ACA meetings now.
Oh, good.
You know, adult alcoholics.
Oh, good.
Trying to address a lot of that stuff because it's like, it's, you know, it's you, when you said like, it's like when I was feeling good in that time, you know, it was also like, I think you said that when it was the pandemic. So it's like, no one was like feeling anything, you know, it's like, and then I think, I can't remember who it was just like, he saw me once. He was like, hey, Jonah's here as anxious as ever. And I was like, oh, I didn't realize I was revealing that as much as I did. And so like trying to kind of figure out that stuff. And especially after like, you know, like my friend Neil died, which
oh,
is like,
God, that's right. Yeah.
You know, like it's, that was weird because it's like how much I
when
felt.
When was that?
That was 3 years ago this past Monday is when I found him. Yeah.
Was it during COVID?
Yeah, it was during COVID. It was January 8th.
That was shocking to everybody. What a nice guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's weird, the death during COVID, because, you know, Lynn died during COVID.
Yeah.
It's like it happened in this weird zone of time.
And no one could just come together easily.
Right. That's why.
Yeah, and it was real tricky. It was like, you know, even like finding him,
figure out how he died?
It's pretty much some complications from drinking. I mean, like the isolation, you know. The isolation kind of, I think, really messed him up because he's a very social guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was with him a couple of days before in the mountains. And then, you know, I just swung by his place and just, you know, like, I was like, oh, it looks like he's like sleeping on the couch, you know? And like, I'm like knocking on his window on his porch, trying to wake him up. And like, And then I started like, cause I was on his Wi-Fi. So I was able to start like playing dumb stuff on his TV.
Right.
And I started like, you know, I was like, I got to get this guy awake.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's funny. Cause it's like, I was like, looks like he's breathing. Like, why wouldn't he be breathing?
Right.
Cause he was just like, looks like he was sleeping on his couch. And then, I played a dumb song. I played like jingle farts like through his TV.
Yeah.
You know? And then I was like, I know how I'm going to get him awake. I'm going to play a stand-up clip of his ex-wife.
Jen?
Like, yeah. And then like it worked. And that's when I kind of like saw.
That might have been what killed him.
Yeah. He was holding on until that moment. but it wasn't until like I kind of like noticed that the color of his skin on his arm was weird, and then I had to break into the house, and it's real brutal. And it, you know, the thing is, I had to, and of course, like, you know, in those kind of times, like a bunch of funny stuff. I mean, you did such a great job of the Lynn stuff in your last special, like, and like it was really, really cool to see that, because it's like, you know, like I kind of, you know, all the things that happened that day. Like, he died the same day as Tommy Lasorda, you know, the baseball coach.
Sure.
And his place was right across the street from a Little League field called Tommy Lasorda Field of Dreams.
No.
So, you know, I'm sitting on the curb, like, sobbing, waiting for the, like, you know, like, police or someone to show up. And this, like, you know, nice Audi pulls up, and it's, like, this couple in their Dodger gear. And they're going, are you doing all right? And I was like, yeah, I'm fine. I'm like, why are these people talking to me? And they're like, he was a great man. I was like, what? I didn't tell anyone. They're like, such a good coach. And I was like, all right. And they're like, it's like, we're here with you. And then they drove, and I was like, and I mentioned it to my friend. He's like, oh yeah, Tommy Lasorda died. I was like, Jesus Christ. And like, it's like a bunch of funny stuff like that happened. Like, you know, it's like, you know, when I busted open the window, but I couldn't get through because of the bars at first. I was like, everything on his porch I was throwing at him.
Yeah.
And like, it's like, you know, he had little like whittling things and like a little like like glue and stain for like all these things he was working on his porch. And I was like throwing it at him. And so when the cops came, they asked me, they're like, did he like huff glue or paint? And like, I was like, no, you fucking whittled these dumb horses, you know?
Yeah.
And then the coroner, when he got out of his van, tripped and hit his head on the side of his van, denting it. Like, a bunch of funny stuff happened.
Wow.
And these are the things I'm telling you.
Yeah, fun short film, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. But that's how, like, you know, I just would joke around about these moments instead of, like, processing this kind of traumatic thing.
Yeah,
of, like,
I know, but, you know, like, yeah, but that's not terrible. I mean, because ultimately, what does processing look like? You're only going to do it at the pace you can do it at, and by joking about it, you're not processing.
That's true. You know, it's like, I think it's you're not processing it, but you're maybe not giving it the weight that it deserves.
Yeah, but
the,
I mean, but how much crying are you going to do?
I don't know, Dad. God damn. That's a good thing. Good thing you never had. Well, yeah, how much crying are you going to do?
Fucking cry, baby. Yeah,
walk it off.
Yeah, I mean, come on. I just know that when I was initially in grief, that I could not control the crying.
I couldn't.
And it would happen everywhere. And, you know, like, even though I wasn't seeing that many people. And, you know, and it was unavoidable. So I was experiencing those feelings.
Yeah.
And if I go back to those feelings, I can still, you know, access the feelings and the this sort of horrible, I had to deal with the whole day of dying thing.
Yeah.
You know, cause she was, you know, she's in the hospital.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we were all dealing with it, but like.
You were there.
Yeah, I wasn't at the hospital. I couldn't go to the hospital.
Oh, that's right, because it was fucking, yeah, that's another weird, yeah.
Dude, I guess the point I'm trying to make is, like, in terms of trauma processing and stuff, because I've done some of it around other things.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know that being funny is a way to deflect emotion. I get that. But I don't know that it is suppressing emotion.
No, yeah, I do think, you know, there's something to it, like, you know, and it just really depends. Like, you know, that's the funny thing is, like, Neil and I, you know, like, we probably talked to each other every day for 20 years, you know, and after his dad died of cancer, you know, we would always have this conversation after my dad died of cancer, my dad died of a stroke, like, suddenly. And we'd always have this conversation. It's like, what's worse? Like, just them going right away or like the slow, painful death. And,
look, my dad's got dementia now. I guarantee you this, the quickness is what you want.
Yeah. It's funny. It's like, but you know, like the joke I've been making is, it's like, you know, after Neil dying suddenly and after my dad died suddenly, it's like, can't someone in my life please die a slow, painful death just so I can have some closure?
I want to be able to be there for them.
Yes. Yeah. Just for me to have that moment. Yeah. But like, it's and now we got some gardeners. You're doing pretty good these days. You got gardeners.
What day is today?
It's a Friday.
That is the gardener.
Nice. Not so bad.
Well, what am I going to do? Do you see the size of that fucking?
I know. No,
I can't do it.
Well, maybe if you were tired, you'd have time to snip it.
I'm not that tired. Like, I'm physically not tired.
Yeah.
My brain, like, I get a little overwhelmed. It's anxiety tired.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
It's just sort of.
I'm still trying to figure that stuff out.
Yeah, I can't get peace of mind because my...
You're the one that gives me no hope. Sometimes when you look at like one of your like friends that have like, you know, kind of maybe mentally similar,
sure.
And then like I see you still struggle with it, I was like, oh, so it's just
here
forever?
Yeah, but I'm okay. But it's like, but it's just part of you. I mean, it's a difference between being sort of paralyzed by it and just sort of saying like, that's happened sometimes.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you know what I mean? Like, what are you going to do? Like, just like, you can't reprogram the whole fucking thing.
Yeah, can't hold on to the wind.
Yeah, it's true. And that's exhausting.
Yeah. The whole thing. One day science will figure it out.
You try and you try. Cannot hold on to the wind. But no, I mean, I have an inability to compartmentalize that well. So everything sort of comes in hot.
Yeah.
You know, like there's no difference between like, fuck, I've got to like take that thing out of the fridge.
Yeah,
and I'm waiting for tests from the doctor. Yeah. And I got to talk to you.
These are at the utmost importance. Yeah,
though they just all happen the same vibration, and then I have to sort of go.
You could put that
slow that down.
Yeah. And then how much of that do you think is like from weird traits of like alcoholism or?
I think it's a parenting thing. It's just a panic of
because you said your parents were pretty emotionally detached, right?
Yeah, a little selfish, a little
and they
were emotionally charismatic, but just not in a nurturing way.
Yeah.
So you kind of there was never like it has to do with that, the alcoholism and that kind of stuff. I don't know. I also quit nicotine again. Like I got back involved with that, and I was off everything for a few years. And I got a nicotine. I'm pulling off of that again, and this is like day 12.
Nice.
Exciting withdrawal. But I mean, look, I mean, there are certain things that are just part of me, but my brain just sort of like doesn't know how to relax. And instead I just get suicidal.
Yeah. Well, there's, you know, it's always about trying to find that healthy version of dissociation, you know, and that could be,
that's
you know,
right.
Playing music for me, that's it. You know, like
that's
it's
right.
Like
healthy
just getting loud and just like, you know, loud guitars, loud drums. Like,
it's also
like,
realizing what you have control over and what you don't. What can you do in any moment for what you're feeling?
Yeah.
What is that?
You know, what's a funny thing is like with bartending, it really started to challenge my people pleasing.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's like, you know, I would get stressed if there was more than a couple people waiting for drinks. And I was I'm ruining their good time.
Yeah.
Oh, and like
codependent bartender.
Yeah.
Where's that bit?
Yeah. I mean, maybe SNL did it in the 90s.
Oh,
it's the codependent. It would have a little jingle for it.
But all bartenders are codependent. That's the job.
It's like, you know, it's sometimes I call them like there's like some people that come in and sit down and it's just like, you are there to give them a drink and to listen and talk to them. I call them punishers. Sometimes they're great, but sometimes they'll just slowly reveal themselves to you and it's not good. It gets worse and worse the more you give them.
Yeah.
And
here comes a regular.
Exactly.
It's call out my name.
And it's funny because it's like, you know, it's funny you say that too, because like I think a lot about like, you know, one of my favorite bands is Dillinger Four out of Minneapolis. I really do think like they are the, you know, successors to the style of the
replacements,
not musically, but like, you know, stylistically and, you know, idea wise. But they're like, you know, those guys are all bartenders.
Oh, yeah.
And like, it's like, I think that, you know, that's the kind of stuff that makes me, you know, feel good. It's, you know, they have amazing lyrics, they're very poetic, and, you know, they're provided with this slice of humanity.
I like that how you're slowly framing your shift from comedy to bartending as the correct move creatively. For you. Very good.
Well, these are, you know, we can always try, I can only try and justify my descent into obscurity.
I don't know if it's obscurity. So tell me, let's talk about this movie because I almost didn't watch it all. And
yeah, it's not for you.
I don't know if it's not for me. I mean, I think, but I say that like, well, that's, I was working on this joke.
It's also like 85 minutes, dude.
As I get older, is like, I say this a lot. I'm like, is this terrible or am I just not getting it?
Yeah. I could be both. Two things could be true, as they say.
No, but like, I am capable of watching things that are not for me.
Sure, yeah.
And I know that the movie Destroy All Neighbors, you know, it is a take on a type of horror movie or several.
Yeah, it's a you know, harkening back to that practical effects stuff from like the 80s, like Basket Case or Brain Damage or some of that early, you know, Peter Jackson stuff. You know, it's like, and we only had $2 million to make it.
But it's sourced. Like, you know what you're trying to do.
Well, we're
this
not,
is the genre you're fucking
this is
with.
It's not a parody as much as it's like we just tried to make one of those movies.
No, I know. It didn't feel like a parody.
Yeah. And like, you know, and Alex Winter, who also made those types of movies, he made a movie called Freaked in the early 90s.
Yeah, I remember Freaked.
And, you know, it's like, you know, that kind of stuff.
And he directed it?
No, he was a co-producer with me on it.
And who directed it?
This guy, Josh Forbes, does a lot of commercials and music videos.
But Alex is the main
weirdo. Villain. And then he shows up later as a lawyer.
I saw that. Yeah.
Got to get his face in there somewhere.
Sure.
But like the guy who did his effects is the same guy who did like, you know, Leprechaun and Basket Case. So it's like, you know, we have.
What, the costume, you mean?
His like design.
It's crazy.
Yeah, all this stuff.
A lot of guts.
A lot of guts and gloop. And
yeah.
It's, you know, like, again, like I was saying, it's like that kind of like, these are movies I loved so much as a kid. Like, you know, Street Trash and Basket Case, of course, like Return of the Living Dead. Like, I love gore and I love comedy. And I just like, you know, it's like now I did one of those. I love like Evil Dead 2. So it's like, you know.
Yeah.
And then we also there's like, you know, and some of the horror kids might not notice it, but like, you know, we also pulled from like Delicatessen and Barton Fink and stuff like
that.
You know, the hallway. And
sure, the hallways.
Know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, it's just, it was fun. It's like, you know, it's a low budget little like, you know, splatter comedy.
But it seems like now with the cameras available, a low budget doesn't have to look bad.
No, it's like, you just, it's like,
it does a low budget that you, your low budget does not look like those old, like fucking kind of like gritty movies.
You know, it's funny though. It's like, but materials are more expensive,
right.
And time, everything just costs more. Plus like with those old cameras, like they could get away with so much more because you couldn't see everything exactly.
Sure.
So like, you know, the grittiness of the 60 millimeter being blown up to 32,
right.
You know, for its release in theaters, it's like, it's going to hide a lot of strings. It's going to hide a lot of like the seams.
Now.
Yeah. You
can't
hide anything.
Wow.
Yeah. But I, you know, it's like, I it was very fun. We had a lot of friends involved and the music is like really fun. We had Ryan Kattner from Man Man and Brett Morris like do all the soundtrack for it.
Oh yeah, wait, who is it? Tom Lennon.
Tom Lennon shows up in it. And he's super fun. Kumail shows up in it.
Kumail was funny. That was funny.
Yeah, Phil Hendry.
Phil the cop.
Yeah,
played the cop.
So you basically watched the whole thing.
I watched it.
Oh, okay. You almost didn't finish it.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, it's a fun movie.
I thought it was fun, and I thought like, you know, I thought that while watching it, though, not necessarily source to what I know, I would think that people would enjoy it that like that shit.
Yeah, definitely. It's you know, like I said before, it's just like the kind of make the kind of stuff that would make the younger version of you feel a little less lonely. It's like, oh, there's guys like making weirdo stuff like this.
Sure,
like, that makes me feel a little safer, a little less alone. You know?
Yeah, but also like, it looked fun. And you did a good job acting.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, that's like, you know, like, you know, that's what I was hoping for. It's like, you know, I've been a lead in like, you know, like TV shows and like, but like, you know, for as far as movies, to be able to, you know, hopefully not mess up carrying a movie was very important to me.
Oh, but he also had all those crazy puppet people.
Yeah, there's a lot of puppet people, which is something I'm used to from Mr. Science Theater. You know, like it's like everyone's like, what was that like? I was like, I've been already doing it. Also, I've always enjoyed, like, you know, even in sketch when I did that kind of stuff, like being the straight man, like, you know, and help facilitating like the zaniness of the idea or the characters within it.
Yeah,
has always been something I've like, you know, been really good at, like, you know, like working on Nerdist, working on Mr. Science Theater, working with Kumail. Like, it's like I've always liked facilitating, even like my show Hidden America, like, you know,
codependency and bartending.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all coming around.
It's all in the wheelhouse.
Yeah.
And
you're a drummer, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the same.
Yeah. But here's the weird thing. My drumming, though, I like, it's like, I'm rarely a four on the floor guy. Like, I like getting busy on it. Like, you know, when I was a kid, I was listening to like, you know, this hardcore stuff and this punk stuff, but I was also listening to a lot of jazz.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, I should, in like Stuart Copeland and stuff like that, oh, what if I did these weird, like, kind of like
weird
fills that were the beat?
Strange, syncopated beats.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a lot of clacking on the rim of the, you know, like, but also like love. And then because when you do that and then you slam into like the rhythm, it makes it that much more like chunky and powerful.
Everyone's relieved. That you got out.
At least the fucking blues guitarist guys is like, hey, what if for this one you just keep the rhythm and then I wank off?
Come on. I listen to a lot of jazz.
Hey, man. You talking jazz? Ooh, baby, that jazz.
Well, it was good seeing you, man.
Good seeing you.
And congrats on the movie. I think it's fun. I'm glad you're doing okay.
Thanks.
And,
yeah.
You seem good.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't be too hard on yourself.
You know, I think I'm, if anything, I'm not as good as that last time you said I was doing better, but I'm better than I used to be.
No, you seem good.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's good to confront all this stuff and to, you know, do the work.
Yeah.
But
sometimes, like, you know, there was that time I tried to, like, hang out. It's like, I did want to talk about, like, not that you have done ACA, but, like, it's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure you know about that kind of stuff.
I hear it's, like the best one.
Yeah, it's been really... really incredible. But it's like, I just wanted to talk to you more about that stuff, like, not in this context, but yeah, just like,
it's,
you know,
it's, I think it's specific and it applies to people that grow up in insanity of one kind or another.
Yeah.
And like, because, you know, I'm sure I qualify for having, you know, mentally ill dad and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But I know that the conversation around issues that come from that are beyond just codependency stuff.
Yes, it's all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. Well, I should go with you.
Yeah.
All right, buddy.
All right, man.
There you go. No more comedy for Jonah. No more stand-up anyways. It's a courageous decision. I think he feels all right about it. The movie, Destroy All Neighbors, which I think is worth watching if you like that kind of horror. It's streaming on Shudder and playing in select theaters. Hang out for a second, people. So I talked with Ed Begley Jr. for even longer when he was here, but we couldn't fit it all into this episode. So it's posted now for Full Marin subscribers. You can hear me and Ed talk about his Parkinson's diagnosis, his environmentalism, and Marlon Brando. What was your experience with Marlon?
It was great. He had heard of my environmental work, and he liked that, and he liked that I was handy, too, that I'd like made my dining room table and a chest of drawers. He loved anybody who was handy. He didn't want to talk about show business at all. No talk about acting, writing, directing, puppetry, claymation, trained seals, anything that was showbiz. He didn't want to talk about galvanized pipe versus copper. Loved to talk about that. Wind turbine, solar panels, loved it.
Yeah.
Drywall, you name it.
Subscribe to The Full Marin by clicking the link in the episode description or by going to WTFpod.com and clicking on WTF Plus. Next week, comedian Jacqueline Novak is on Monday, and Moshe Kasher returns on Thursday. This guitar took me a long time. I put it through the echo box, and I screwed it up at the end. It took me a long time, though. Damn. Monkey and LaFonda, cat angels everywhere. That was much harder than it sounded. Jesus Christ.